Still don't know why people take photos of me. I'm old, fat, ugly. As you all know, if you haven't heard me say this before, that, you know, this is not fat. It's not fat. You know what it is? You know, I've told you before, I think, that every year you're a monk, you get more and more kind, more compassionate. This is my 42nd year as a monk. So in all those 42 years, every year my heart's grown bigger and bigger and bigger. And now it's so big it's pushing out my tummy. It's just a big heart, it's not a sort of, not fat, okay? That's my excuse. And it's not a bad excuse either. Because the other thing which I found out, I don't know what I'm talking about this morning, so I'll just make it up as I go along as usual. The other thing which I did find on some nice evidence-based research done in medicine, when you are happy, when you do laugh a lot, your blood vessels expand. They get wider. When you're miserable, angry, critical, your blood vessels contract. So that answered a very important question, which I always wondered, why are fat people always happy and jolly? Yeah, they are. And the reason is, because if you're fat and you're not happy, you don't laugh very much, it's called double whammy. You get lots of gut going through your blood vessels and your blood vessels are so narrow. That's why you die. But if you're happy and laugh a lot, your blood vessels are so wide. They're so huge, like superhighways. You can eat anything because nothing gets stuck inside. It's just so wide. So if you like eating chips and all this other very delicious stuff, then make sure you laugh a lot, because that balances it, then you'll be very healthy. Wide blood vessels, so lots of stuff can go through. And that's so true. One of my heroes, his, I don't know how old he is, but he's been around. I knew him when I was young. He was fat and he's still alive. I saw him just last month. Father Christmas. It's true, he's really happy. And he's fat too. Have you ever seen a thin Father Christmas in the shopping centres? I always wondered as a kid how he fits down the chimney. Without getting stuck. Always happy, always laughing, therefore always healthy. So it's important, always, whether it's in life, whether it's in meditation, always to learn how to find happiness wherever it is. Even if you find miserable, then enjoy being miserable. Find fun. That's why if ever you are very miserable, see how miserable you can get. See if you can get into the Guinness Book of Records of misery. In other words, whatever you do, give everything you've got, for goodness sake. Don't just be half miserable. Really go for it. And then you find you can't be miserable very much afterwards. You're always happy. It's like one of Ajahn Chah's teachings. Someone once asked him, he had an anger problem. So how can I overcome my anger? And with the great innovation of an Ajahn Chah, he gave this wonderful little method. If you have an anger problem, always getting angry, the next time you're angry, sit down. Take it like a clock, like an alarm clock, put it in front of you, and see how long you can get angry for. See if you can beat your PB, your personal best. Because all that is doing is actually objectifying the anger. Instead of actually getting into it and just thinking about that terrible person or that terrible thing which is making you angry, you're just standing back, like that simile of watching the movie I said last night. When you're right inside the movie, you've got no objectivity at all, and you shout at the people who are making mistakes, and you cry when the two lovers finally meet. Oh, that's so sweet. And you feel so sad when somebody dies. For those of you who want to see evidence of reincarnation, just watch a movie. You watch it the next rerun, and the person who died, you know, is alive again. Proves it, you know, black and white or colour, right in front of you. Reincarnation, all the movies reincarnate. But why we get sucked into there is because we've got no objectivity. And okay, it's not that hard to get objectivity of your thoughts. When you're angry and upset, for goodness sake, just stand back and look what you're doing to yourself. That's one of the reasons why, that if you do get angry, find the nearest mirror and look how you look like. Even better, take a selfie when you're angry. And remind yourself. Now put that as your screensaver. You know, on anyone who hacks into your account, they look at that, ooh, and they hack out again as soon as possible, including you. Because you look really ugly when you get angry. You look like a monster. You're frightening. And so, that's one way of getting some mindfulness. These days, we always talk about mindfulness and skillful means to use modern technology for mindfulness. If you ever do have problems like that, always angry, or always, you know, have some addictions like alcohol, or you know someone who gets drunk, then out of compassion for them, out of kindness, get out your smartphone and take a video of them when they're drunk. And then, when they're sober, show it to them. No private, not to embarrass them or punish them. Say, look, this is what you're like when you're drunk. And they take one look at that, and for a lot of them, it's a wake-up call. They don't realize how they look and how they act and how they speak, because they're not there when they're drunk. So it's a wonderful little way of getting some mindfulness up in different problems of life. But in particular this morning, I just asked, I think last night, Bianca, what's happening tomorrow? Because I don't really know too much what happens. I just, you know, wing it as usually, just one day at a time. But apparently tomorrow is the last day of the retreat. So you think. Because one of my favorite stories was of this New Zealand monk. Now this is ordained about the same time as me, but in the Korean tradition. His name was Ham Wol, very nice monk. And he went to Korea and ordained as a monk in that tradition. And that is a very, very tough tradition. Every year they do a retreat. Not 9 days, not 3 weeks, 60 days retreat. And he described to me what it was like. You get up at, I think, 3 o'clock in the morning. And you have to start meditating. 45 minutes sitting, quarter of an hour walking, all throughout the day. At breakfast time, you don't even move, you have your breakfast exactly where you're meditating. You don't even get the opportunity just to go for a little walk. Lunch the same, it's brought to you, and you don't move. And even in the evening, you sleep just right where you were meditating. So you can't go off and hide. And the only two excuses is to go out to the toilet or to go and see the master for interview. And going to an interview with a Korean Zen master is very, very different than going to an interview with the soft, cuddly toy Ajahn Brahm. When people were asking last night, they say, the soft toys, can we borrow them because there are none left? I hope you meant the soft toys there, the cuddly toys, not the cuddly nuns and the cuddly monks, to borrow them, because they're soft toys too, in a different way. But the master was really fierce. So this was a young New Zealander starting his first 60-day retreat. And of course, you know, no chairs, had to sit on the ground. And of course, you notice how much I can hurt sometimes. And he told me that just after 3 or 4 days, he was hurting so badly, aching, pain all over the place, and still had a long time to go yet. He said every day was a struggle. You know, that walking 15 minutes, then back down again, when he went to sleep at night about 10 o'clock, as soon as he lay down, someone rang the bell. It was 3 o'clock already. And he was going on and on like that. He got through his first week. He managed to do 2 weeks, and he wanted to run away. But he told me that the reason he didn't run away was just racial pride. He saw these Asians sitting there nicely, and he was a Westerner from New Zealand. He thought, if they can do it, I can do it. He was really struggling. And of course, he got to the halfway mark. You know how psychology is. You think, well, I've got halfway. The rest will be easy, all downhill from here. But it doesn't work like that in meditation. The halfway, the pain starts to increase exponentially. So the next 4 weeks was about worth 1 year. They went so slowly. And again, every time he thought of running away, he thought that would be unfaithful to all the pain and effort he'd done so far. It would make it useless. So he kept on and on. He had a huge willpower to be able to endure these aches and pains. But as usually happens, it gets to the last day of the retreat. And even though it was the last day, only had a few hours to go, that was when the pain really started. It's like the pain had been waiting all this time. And now was pulling no punches. It really went for him. He was struggling. Every 1 minute was just an endurance battle. First morning sitting gone, then he could walk, then back down again. The legs ached, the knees ached, the butt ached, the shoulder ached, the ears ached, everything aches. Well, I don't think he said the ears ached, but you know what I mean. It's just when you're in that sort of mood, everything is painful. But he endured and he endured and he endured. And of course it finally came to the last session. Only 45 minutes to go. And after that session, in those Zen monasteries, they don't have the rules about not eating in the afternoon. At the end of the retreat, there was hot baths. You can just soak and get all those aches and pains out of your body. And a big feast, really delicious food, as much as you wanted, to celebrate that you've done something very difficult, finished the retreat. And that last meditation, he was dreaming about the hot bath. He could imagine his legs just soaking into the warm water and all the tension just vanishing. Thinking of just gorging himself on this amazing food because he'd worked so hard for it. And that last meditation lasted for hours. He said he would, every now and again, he would open his eyes to peek at the clock. Only 5 minutes had gone past. He could assure it was about at least 20. And he closed his eyes again. Okay, let's wait for 20 minutes. Peeked again, only 3 minutes had gone past. Time seemed to be going slower. And being a Westerner, having had a good education in science, he started to imagine maybe the batteries in the clock were running out. That's why the clock was going slow. And then he thought the terrible thought, what happens if the batteries run out totally and the clock stops and that last meditation lasts for 3 hours? Oh my God. And it was torture. The minutes dragged like you're going uphill in treacle. And it was so difficult for him. But of course, the moment came. The final gong. Retreat was ended. And he felt these incredible feelings of achievement and happiness and relief. He'd done it. And it was really hard. It was not an easy thing to accomplish. And he felt just so blissed out he'd managed to achieve something. And then the master said, before you all get up, I want an announcement to make. So during the interviews, you've all been showing great progress in your meditation. Amazing progress. And a few of you have asked, is it possible, can we please extend the retreat for another 2 weeks? Having considered that, I think that's an appropriate idea. Retreat carries on. Sit down. And at that point, this monk told me he never felt any pain at all. He just felt sheer anger. Try to work out who these bastard monks were who had told this stupid suggestion and what he was going to do with them. He had all these incredibly unmonkish things of torturing them, hanging them upside down and poking them. And oh, he's just going to do terrible things to these monks once he found out who it was. And that is, as he was thinking how he could kill these monks slowly, the bell went again. Half an hour had gone past, just like a flash. Because when you're angry, that's what it's like. It goes very quickly. And then the master said, retreat over. Have your baths. Food available downstairs. Off you go. And this poor monk got very, very confused. This is his first retreat. He said, what's happening? Is it over? Is it not over? And the other monk said, that master, he does the same trick every year. And he told me he learned more in that half an hour from that little trick than through the whole 60 days. Anticipation is a great cause for suffering. Expectation is asking for trouble. So is the retreat going to finish tomorrow? During your interviews, many of you. So that's the trouble with our life, and that's why it was a wonderful little teaching of Dhamma, just how we always expect for the future, and the future never turns out the way we expect it. So please, if you have packed your bags already, unpack them. Don't pack them to the very, very last moment. Because you've seen yourself always be doing like that. You were so excited to come on this retreat, waiting and packing and getting yourself ready, and now you're here, hasn't finished yet, and you're already, already home, already travelled, already expected what you're going to do. Pack your bags, getting ready. And that's wasting a lot of time. And you're losing the insight of the present moment. That is why one of my favourite stories, here it comes again, another of my old stories. And again, if you've heard it before, it's your fault. Especially if you've heard it many times. You come every time for these retreats, give other people a chance, and give me a chance to tell the same stories and see people laugh instead of groan, oh no, not again. But it's a beautiful story. I heard this at an airport. I was sitting in an airport, I forget actually where now, I was chatting with a guy, and he was actually from the Middle East. This was a Middle Eastern story. I don't know where this came from, but I adapted it, and it's a wonderful story, and it's the story which is actually going to be one of the books over in the United States. It's going to be the title of a new book. And it's called Old Monks Don't Lie. It's a great story and a great line. So what happened? There was an old monk. And he would not be attached to any monastery. He'd walk around India or wherever he was, staying under a tree or staying in a house or an abandoned monastery, just having the freedom of having no attachment to any place or people. And being a monk, you can do that. You just take your alms bowl, you can go an alms round and people will feed you. So he went to a poor farmhouse. And they were Buddhists, and so they saw the old monk, and they gave him a very nice meal. And at the end of the meal, the farmer said, it's going to be the retreat period soon, the rains retreat, when the monks and the nuns have to stay put for 3 months. Have you got a place yet to stay for the rains retreat? And the old monk said, no. And so the farmer went on his knees and put his hands up, please, Venerable Sir, stay with us. There's a paddock close to a river, very nearby. I can build you a very simple hut. So I said last night, you don't need a mansion for a monk. It's so simple to look after a monk. In fact, it's so simple to look after monks that when our first monks went to England, one of the committee members of the group looking after him, who later became an advisor to the Bank of England, so he knew about economics, that he tried to work out, can we afford looking after these monks? So he did a quick calculation, how much it costs to look after a Buddhist monk. And he came up with a wonderful answer that looking after a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun is much cheaper than looking after a dog. And there's so many similarities. The dogs live in little huts in your garden, same as nuns. Dogs eat out of a bowl, so do monks and nuns. And dogs, they're very kind. They wag their tail whenever they see you, just like monks and nuns if we had a tail. And you take them for a walk, and they're very happy. They never bite you. So there's many similarities with pet dogs and monks and nuns, and they're very cheap to look after, which is, he came to the conclusion, every home should have one. Take one home with you afterwards. But anyway, so it's very cheap to look after. So this farmer, he could get a nice little hut for the monk, and the monk accepted. And the deal was that he'd come every day for alms round, and they'd feed him once a week. They would ask for some advice, maybe some advice on meditation, a little Dharma talk, and also for his 2 children as well. And so that was what happened. The range retreat started to come every day, and the family started to fall in love with this old monk. The kids loved him, and he gave some really nice advice, and even the little dog loved this old monk. To the point that at the end of the range retreat, the monk came for alms round one day and said, "The range retreat is finishing tomorrow, I will have to leave." And that was such a shock to this family. The wife and the farmer, they fell down on their knees, begging him, "Please don't leave us. We love you like an old grandfather. You're too valuable to us." And the children started crying, "No, please don't leave." And even the dog put his tail between his legs and started whining. I can't do dog whines. Can you do dog whines? If I try, I give anything a go. And so they were begging him to stay, but he said, "Look, I can't stay. It's my life. I wander around, don't attach to any place. I have to go tomorrow morning." But he said, "You've been very kind to me, and my meditation has been very powerful and very deep. I have developed some powers. And using those powers, I have discovered, not far from here, closer than you think, there's a buried treasure. Lots and lots of gold. I don't need it, I'm just a monk. I want you to have it, so that you and your family don't have to live in poverty any longer." And even though they were going to miss their favorite monk, they thought, "Oh, we're going to be rich tomorrow." Because they knew they were going to be rich, because old monks don't lie. But the monk looked at them seriously and said, "But to find this treasure, you have to follow my instructions exactly." So they all listened. The farmer listened, the wife listened, even the kid, even the dog listened. The old monk said, "Tomorrow morning, at dawn, you have to stand at the doorway to your little hut and face the rising sun. You have to pick up that bow and arrow which you have, and as the sun rises, point the arrow and the bow in the direction of the rising sun. And as the sun rises above the horizon, let the arrow fly. And where that arrow falls, there you will find the treasure. But only if you follow my instructions." Simple enough, they thought. So they said goodbye to the monk. And that night they were so excited they hardly slept. Tomorrow they'd be rich. So he was up about 3 o'clock in the morning, waiting for the sun to rise. When the crack of dawn appeared on the horizon, he was there with a bow and arrow, waiting for that sun to come up. And when the sun came up, he picked up the bow and arrow, he pointed the bow and arrow towards the rising sun, and just when the full disk of the sun appeared above the horizon, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And they all ran after it, the wife, the kids, even the dog ran as well. And as soon as they found the arrow where it fell, they knew they were going to be rich. And because this was Asia, the wife had to dig the hole. But be warned, if you are gender specific like that, if you exploit your wives like that, something will happen to you. Karma. So anyway, the wife dug the hole. She dug and dug and dug. And what did she find? Nothing. Only trouble. Because that arrow had landed in a property in a field belonging to this rich guy. And this rich guy found them and said, "You can't dig in other people's property. That is against the law. I'm going to sue you and take all your farmlands, your hut, everything." Did a bad thing. And the wife said, "Not my fault. Husband told me to do it." Husband, not my fault. The old monk told us we'll find a treasure here. And at that word, old monk, the rich man stopped and said, did you say old monk? Yes. And even the rich man said, old monks, don't lie. There's something going on here, because I'm a Buddhist too. What happened? And so they told this rich man what the monk had said. And the rich man said, oh, it's obvious what your mistake was. Look at you, you're a poor farmer, you don't eat well, you're too weak, you don't know how to shoot a bow and arrow. I am rich, I am well fed, I've got muscles on me. Well, they're really fat, but I've got muscles on me, he said. I will do a deal with you, I won't sue you in the court if you agree that tomorrow morning I will shoot that arrow and we'll split the money 50-50. And the farmer had no choice. So the following morning, the rich man was at the threshold of the house at the doorway, waiting for the sun to come up. And when it came up, he pointed a bow and arrow towards the rising sun. And as the sun just rose above the horizon, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. It went much further this time, so they all ran after it. The rich man sweating, the farmer, his wife, the two kids, and of course, the dog. The dog is important in this story. Remember. And where the arrow landed, because of the calm of getting someone else to do your dirty work, this time the farmer had to dig the hole. He dug and dug and dug and dug. And what did he find? Nothing. Only more trouble. Because this time it landed in a field belonging to a general in the army. And the general just happened to be coming around with some of his soldiers and saw people destroying his property. And he said, that is against the law. Soldiers, cut their heads off. Even the dog, cut his head off. And the dog started whining. And the rich man said, it's not my fault, it's not my fault. This farmer said, an old monk said there'd be some treasure here. And at that, the general said, put your swords down. Because the general was a Buddhist as well. And he said, did you say old monk? Because old monks, they never lie. What did he tell you? And when they told him the instructions, the general said, oh, you stupid lot of people. What does a farmer or a rich man know about shooting a bow and arrow? You have to be in the military. I've trained shooting bows and arrows all my life. He said, look, out of respect for that old monk, tomorrow morning I will shoot that bow and arrow. And we'll split it three ways, okay? And they all agreed. So the following morning, the general was at the doorway of the house, standing perfectly straight like generals do. And when the sun started to rise, he picked up the bow, and he put the arrow in, he pulled that string so far back. He'd been training all his life for this moment. And as the sun rose, he aimed the bow and arrow so it goes the furthest, perfect angle. And he shot that arrow. And they all ran a huge distance after that arrow. The general, the rich man, the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog. Where that arrow landed this time, it was the rich man's task to dig the hole. He dug and dug, did this rich man. And what did he find? Nothing, only more trouble. Because this it's a nice race. I didn't know what I was going to talk about tonight, so this wastes quite a lot of time. And what did they find? Nothing, only more trouble, because this time it landed in a field belonging to His Majesty the King. And the King's Royal Guard captured everyone, including the general. And they brought, and the dog of course, and they brought everybody right in front of the King in court. Said, we found these people digging in your palace garden. And the king said, didn't you know, general, that that is a capital offence? You all have to be executed, even though that you're one of my best generals. I have to apply the law. You're all sentenced to death. And the general said, your majesty, it's not my fault. This rich man said there'll be a treasure here. And the rich man said, it's this farmer's fault. He keeps on saying to find a treasure. And the farmer said, it's not my fault. An old monk told me that I'd find a treasure here. And at that, the king said, "Did you say old monk?" Because even the king was a Buddhist. And he said, "Old monks don't lie. What did they tell you? What did the old monk say to you?" And when the king heard the instructions, he couldn't understand what they did wrong. So he said, "Listen, this is really interesting. I'm going to just suspend your sentence until we find that monk and find out, get to the bottom of this." So they put everybody in jail, including the dog. They gave him a nice little cell, looking after them while they were in jail. And he sent his guards out to find that monk. They searched the countryside. Soon they found him and they brought him back to the palace. And so they got all the culprits out of jail and the monk as well in front of the king and said, "Old monk, I'm surprised at you. You're supposed to be compassionate and wise. You've just got all these people into big trouble. Why?" And the old monk said, "Your Majesty, because they did not follow my instructions." Just like any of you, if you haven't got jhana yet, don't blame me. I'm an old monk. I don't lie. You haven't followed instructions. And just like you're thinking, "What did I do wrong?" The king said, "What did we do wrong?" And the old monk said, "Your Majesty, you come to that poor man's house tomorrow morning. I'm going to ask you to complete the instructions. And I guarantee you'll find a treasure there. But I would ask you to please divide that treasure equally, four ways. One for the poor farmer and his family, one for the rich man, one for the general, and one for yourself. That's the only fair. And even for you, Your Majesty, a quarter of that treasure would make you really, really happy. It's a lot of gold. Imagine just how that would look after the poor man and his family." And again, the king was really interested. So, following morning, the king was there with the general, the rich man, the father, his wife, and the two kids, and, of course, the dog. He was there as well. You can't get the dog out of this important character. And the monk as well. And just as the dawn was coming up, the king moved to the doorway of the house. And he looked back at the old monk, and the old monk said, "Correct, Your Majesty." As the sun came up, the king lifted up the bow and arrow and put the arrow in the bow. He looked back at the old monk, and the old monk said, "Correct, Your Majesty." And as the sun came up, he pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun and looked back at the monk, "Correct, Your Majesty." And as the sun came above the horizon, the king was about to shoot the arrow, "Wrong, Your Majesty." And the Majesty went, "What am I doing wrong? That's what you said." "No, Your Majesty. I said, let the arrow fly." And the king thought for a few seconds, and he released the arrow from between his thumb and forefinger, and the arrow fell right down between his feet, right where he was standing. And there they dug a very small hole and found an immense treasure, a quarter of which would satisfy a king. And imagine how that satisfied the poor farmer and his family. They lived so easily. Even the dog had the best sausages served out of a silver bowl for the rest of his life. He was a very, very happy dog. That's why he loved that monk. And the old monk said, "But it's not just treasure you found there. When you let the arrow of craving go, where does it fall? Right where you are, right where you're standing or sitting. And that is the place you will find the greatest treasure. Right where you're sitting, or standing, or sleeping, whatever you're doing right now, that is where the treasure of freedom and joy lives. Much closer than you think." And that is absolutely true. Because, as I said earlier, this is my 65th year. I am an old monk now. And old monks don't lie. That's a nice old story. You can tell that to kids, and the kids love it too, because they can understand it. People once told me, they said, I know why you have many disciples, because you treat us all like children. There's a lot of truth in that. So simple stories that people can understand, but with profound meanings. So, are you looking for jhana? Nimittas? Anything? Remember where the treasure is. Right where you're sitting. Let go of the arrow of craving, the arrow of wanting. And when you actually let it go, it's right here, where you are. Which reminds me of this one. So many stories. One story of this Malaysian lady, and some of you in Dhammasala know this person. Well, I don't mind saying she's now a nun. But she was on a retreat with me in Thailand somewhere, and just like each one of you, getting absolutely nowhere. Meditating, falling asleep, being restless, watching the breath sometimes, most times not, and getting really, really frustrated. And 9-day retreat, by the end of the retreat, by lunchtime, pretty much a waste of time. But after lunch, her bus or taxi taken to the airport wasn't going to come for another hour and a half. And she had nothing to do. So she decided to meditate, in her own words, to kill time. Because her taxi hadn't arrived yet. So she just meditated to kill time. And an hour later, she came to see me. And I can visualize her now. I was sitting in the chair having a cup of tea. She was kneeling on the ground, her hands up, looking at me with these teary eyes. Oh, it's so lovely. Oh, it's so wonderful. It's so nice. Thank you so much. Or something like that. She was so blissed out. The first time forever, actually, she got a really nice deep meditation. I said, why? What did you do? She said, actually, because I did nothing. I was just killing time, that's all. I said, exactly. You spent all those first 8 days or 9 days trying this and trying that and doing this and doing something else, trying all these methods, and you haven't been listening to my instructions at all. Let go. No desire, no wanting, just be here. Just make peace. Whatever's in front of you, the most important thing, just care for it, just leave it alone. And she did it at last. She followed my instructions, or the instructions of Ajahn Chah, the instructions of the Buddha, and she found a great treasure. So that treasure is right where you're sitting. Have a look under your mat. And that is marvelous little teachings. You don't realize how close that treasure is to you. Sometimes people think, oh, I'll be meditating. You have to be a monk or a nun years and years and years and years before you get enlightened. It's not the way. You don't realize how close you are. But you can be that close for ages, for years. You know, living in the house, and the treasure is right under the doorstep, but you never look there, you're always looking somewhere else. It's over there, somewhere else, anywhere else but here. And that is the problem of human life. Always looking for happiness somewhere else. There's the old Zen tale of a man was looking for a flame to light the wood to boil his rice. He's looking for a flame with a candle. Where's the flame? Where's the flame? If he only knew what a flame was, he'd have cooked his rice much earlier. And that's what we're doing. We're looking anywhere else except for here, for peace, for happiness. And we think it's something we have to attain, not what we already have. So if you can learn how just to stop, let go, let the arrow fall right where you're sitting, right in this tired old body, in this sick old body. Even the sick old body, you know, I can only go on my own experiences, but I had scrub typhus once, and it was a very terrible disease. I was really so weak. It was in one of these, it was 1973 or 4 or something, in northeast of Thailand, third world country, and backwoods, Monks ward of the hospital, no one there. That was the ward, for those of you who are doctors or nurses here. I felt really terrible, had a fever for days, so they put me in hospital, didn't know what it was. And about 6 beds on either side of this ward, you know, like the old wards in the old hospitals. And about a dozen monks there. And at the front desk, there was a nurse. 6 p.m, the nurse vanished. Just went. 7 o'clock, 7:30, the replacement nurse hadn't come. So I asked the man next to me, look, should we go and tell someone the replacement nurse hasn't come up, the night nurse hasn't arrived? Because, you know, in the hospital, you know, if that happens, you're in big danger. And the monk told me, so what are you talking about? There is no night nurse. We only have a nurse maybe in the daytime. At night time, if something goes wrong, it's just unfortunate karma. You know, that I wasn't that good a Buddhist. That was scary. I want to go home. And it was so tiring, having a fever, that you know, had to sort of struggle to get from one bed to another, hold on to the railings at the end, to get to the toilet at the end of the ward. No bedpans, nothing. It was terrible. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of fever, you just don't have any energy at all. You know, you're lying in bed feeling that death might be better for you. And there I was getting really depressed. Very, very achy, a lot of pain and a lot of tiredness. And then I just decided, oh, that was the time also, if you haven't heard this, Ajahn Chah came to visit me. The great master came to visit little me. And I was just, don't ask me to visit you, because if I visit you, you get into big trouble, like this poor lady. She's a member of our Buddhist society. The first time she'd ever been in hospital, really, because you know, and it was for a hysterectomy. And if any of you women have had hysterectomies, you know what it's like. Have this big sort of scar in your chest. And as soon as I came in the room to see her, to visit her, because she was a bit sort of stunned by this, she said, Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell me any jokes. It's so painful to laugh. And I said, it's a bit late. I can't stop. This poor lady, she was laughing and screaming at the same time. I wasn't very compassionate, but that's my nature. I just can't help but tell jokes at the most inopportune place. So please don't invite me to your ward if you've got wounds and laughing is going to hurt you, because I can't stop. Anyway, I was in hospital feeling terrible. Oh, Ajahn Chah came in, and that's when I felt so elated. You know, you felt, you know, honoured. This great monk would come, spend the time to come and visit you. Wow. And so I forgot all my aches and pains for about a second or two. Until Ajahn Chah opened his mouth. He was a very wise monk, but his bedside manner was terrible. He came up to me, honestly. And he said, Bhamawang, sir. Yes, master. You'll get better or you'll die. And then he left. Thank you, great master. That's not what I was expecting. I didn't want to hear that. But the problem is you couldn't complain, because that was so true. You either get better or you die. The sickness doesn't last. So what the hell? And in my case, the sickness didn't last. I got better. But what really proved to me that what you can do, you're sitting there feeling really terrible, really awful, and as awful as you can probably get in life, and decided to meditate, to let go. Instead of wanting to be better, instead of trying to get well, and try to beat down the pain or find some escape from it, I just let it be. It's more like out of desperation than anything else. Not out of wisdom, but I've had enough. So you let go. And then you went straight inside, into your breath, into the delight, into nimittas, and into what goes after nimittas. Incredible peace. And because the contrast was so strong, and if having a really sick, painful, exhausted body to get into these beautiful, brilliant mind states afterwards, that was just some of the best bliss you could ever have, because of the contrast. When you came out afterwards, you didn't worry about being sick. I really love to have, I wish I was wiser, but that probably was, it was about right, but I wasn't really checking my health. That was probably the time when the fever broke. You get into those deep states of meditation, fevers and stuff can't stand that. You heal yourself. It's very, very powerful. not just the bliss and the profundity, but just its effect on your body. So it's marvelous being able to do that. What showed me, is that that treasure is right here, no matter what you're experiencing. Even if you're sick, you're dying, you're in great pain. If you can just let the arrow of craving fall, drop, this is the treasure you find. So much peace, so much freedom, so much happiness. That's a wonderful thing to know. And it also is a wonderful way of understanding the wisdom of everybody in life, thinking, when I get this, then I'll be happy. Once the retreat is over, then I can relax. When I've had my lunch, then I can sort of have a nice rest. When, you know, I retire, then I can be happy. This, so much of our life is just, when something is finished, then I'll be happy. When the retreat is over, said Hamwol, the Korean monk, then I can have my bath, then I can relax, then I can be peaceful. Those retreats are never over. Life is never over. You die, you get reborn again. Here we go again. So where can you ever find peace and happiness? And the answer was right here, right now, in this very moment, in this old body of yours, aching, painful, old, young, stupid, intelligent, girl, boy, transgender, lesbian, gay, questioning. Did I leave anyone out? But anyway, they always add another letter on the end, so I have to keep up with the times. So anyway, this is where, doesn't matter who you are, what you are, sick, old, young, healthy, intelligent, stupid. If you're stupid, there's this great story of the most stupid monk in Thailand. He probably would have got in the Guinness Book of Records, because if you haven't got anywhere yet in meditation, this is a nice story which will give you some encouragement. Because this monk, he was a kid, growing up in a village in the northeast of Thailand, and they had usually 4 years of education. He went to grade one, school in grade one, and at the end of the year, the teacher failed this boy. He actually failed grade one. I've never heard of that before. You can actually fail grade one. I mean, what do? Plasticine wrong, crayons, you can't do crayons, you get the wrong way around. What can you do wrong in grade one? But he did. And so the teacher failed him. So he had to repeat the year, grade one, okay? So another year, all his friends went up into grade two. He had to stay in grade one. And after the second year in grade one, she held him back. He had to repeat grade one a third time. And after 3 years in grade one, he failed again. There was no other option but just to kick him out of school. He was really Guinness Book of Records dumb. So there he was, you know, so stupid that there's no way that he could... Actually, this reminds me of a nice joke once. When the Vietnamese first came to Australia, there's one of these great Vietnamese Australian comics, I forget his name now, but I read his little biography and he told this wonderful joke. And he said that when he went to school, his teacher started talking about IQ, IQ. So he asked his Vietnamese dad, "What does IQ mean, Dad?" And his father replied, "Well, IQ is a measure of your intelligence. You know, the average is 100. If you've got 100 IQ, you know, you're just your average. 120, you know, you're really intelligent, you'll do 130, 140, you'll probably go to university. If you're only 80, then you're a bit stupid, but you know, you can get by in life. If you're only IQ of 60, you're so stupid, you can't probably even tie up your own shoelaces." And so the boy said, "Oh, is that why all Australians wear thongs?" That's brilliant. Anyway, back to where was I with, the stupid boy in school, yeah. So this stupid boy in school, he was 3 years, he missed out grade one and got thrown out. So the only place to go for a kid like that, you know, he's too stupid to, you know, to do any work in the fields or look after water buffaloes, wouldn't know one end of a water buffalo from another end. So the only place they can send such people was the Buddhist temple. So he sent him to the Buddhist temple. So the abbot there could actually do something to teach this guy. And as a Buddhist, everybody has to know some chanting. And so he was learning Namo Tassa. Now, even if you're not a Buddhist, you probably learned that by now, Namo Tassa Bhagavato. But this poor fellow, he managed to get Namo, and he was on the Tassa word. And so what was that first word again? It really was, you know, very, very stupid. But monks are incredibly patient, and this abbot was patient with him for a couple of years and realized that even he could not do anything with this boy. So the last resort, the last place they send people who are too stupid to be able to chant even Namo Tassa was a forest monastery, where I come from. Now this is not my story. It's not his story either. So he sent to the forest monastery, and the monk there just gave him the meditation instructions, just watch your breath. And this guy was so simple, didn't have any thoughts. He just watched his breath, the easiest thing in the world for him. Got into jhanas, got enlightened, became a famous saint, an arahat. And in his life story, that he had to do chanting, and the way he did his chanting was a really fascinating trick. This life he just couldn't learn any chanting whatsoever. But because he had deep meditation, he could remember a past life. In his previous life, he did have a good brain, which he could learn the chanting. So whenever he had to do any ceremony, he actually connected with his previous life, you know, sort of brought the chanting from his past life and chanted it in this life. That's the only way he could do it, getting his memory. He couldn't memorize anything in this life, but he could memorize his past life where he did know the chanting. And he brought that up. And that's what he did. Remember like Dharma Ruan, who could chant all the Paritas by getting his previous life? So that's actually the sort of thing he did. And he became this really, really famous, amazing monk. So if any of you feel stupid, wonderful. You're going to be a great enlightened being. And if any of you are intelligent and got degrees and stuff, bad luck. That's the trouble. We've been trained how to think at school and at life in university. Now we're teaching you to feel, to be. You've been trained how to search for fulfillment in the future, to put out goals somewhere else, anywhere else but now. Always looking for something in the future, tomorrow, and forgetting about this present moment. Just right now. So, that story of the old man's don't lie, is a very powerful one. It's not just a joke. It actually shows you where the treasure really lies in life. Whether it's in your home, or your family, especially with enlightenment. Right now, that's where you have the happiness. And in fact, someone once asked me, so what are these Four Noble Truths? Actually, some of you asked me on the first night, and I told you the Four Noble Truths. Life is shit, the cause of shit, how to let go of shit, and the path leading to the end of shit. But that's, you know, just being a bit gross. But using modern language, fair enough. But you can always say the Four Noble Truths in one sentence. It's when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And that's such a brilliant line. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. That's Four Noble Truths. So, what do you want now? This day, the Saturday, what do you want today? If you want something more, you'll never be able to enjoy it today. Already many of you have been sitting out there on the stupas, having a cup of tea. You don't want anything, you don't want nimittas, you don't want jhana, and you're enjoying it. You sit here, if you want to get nimittas or jhanas, you don't have the joy, which is a necessary ingredient of those deep meditation states. So always remember Four Noble Truths in one line. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So you sit here, I don't want anything more. And then you do enjoy what you already have. You get happiness. Mindfulness increases. You get bliss. Incredible things happen. I don't want anymore. I'm enjoying what I already have. And then this amazing thing called jhanas, enlightenment, they come to you again. The Buddha was so profound when he gave his teachings. Four noble truths, yeah, but we don't apply them to meditation. We keep on wanting stuff. Doesn't matter how many times you hear that, no matter how many times the Buddha teaches it, we take that arrow, we fire it all over the place. When I get jhana, then I'll become enlightened. When I can meditate, then I become enlightened. When I've had a cup of tea, gone to the toilet, afterwards, then I become enlightened. Never realizing you become enlightened right now. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. You don't go in anymore. You go on, out. So here in this meditation, don't want anything from here on in. Be honest with yourself. How many of you have achieved any good meditation so far? It's 8 days. Admit it, you're hopeless. Admit it, you can't get anything. You're not good meditators. Admit it. So give up. Give up trying to get jhanas, trying to get enlightened for goodness. Give it up. Let it go. You're not going to get anywhere. And when you have that attitude, you don't strive to get somewhere. You let go of the arrogance, then you might actually achieve something. But when you try, you won't. When you let go, you do. So, but be careful there, because sometimes people say, okay, one day to go, I'm going to let go. I don't want anything at all. This day I'm just going to be in the moment. And they come, it didn't happen. It didn't work, Ajahn Brahm. Of course it didn't work. You wanted something to happen. You didn't really let go. You were going to let go as a deal. I will let go if you give me jhanas. Please, now understand what goes on, so just let go and enjoy yourself. So this is the last day here, you're not going to get jhanas, you're not getting light, so give that up. So now you're free, you don't have to get anything, you don't have to do anything. This day you can enjoy it. And see what happens. Sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu! Very good. Okay. I don't know how that worked, but anyway, that's all you're getting.